Rocking chair sessions. With Elisa Di Battista, Maria Teresa Barber.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome to another RCS Rocking Chair Sessions featuring Chato Oquette, session number 126.
Volume 126.
Thank you so much for coming, Charo.
Charo is getting ready. She's very comfortable in her rocking chair. We were already talking about how rocking chairs are a staple. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, staple. It's something that you find in most Dominican households. It's something she said you find
inside. But not just one,
inside.
But four.
Yeah, like a family set, which normally in Panama, where I'm from, you normally have them on the veranda, like when you take your siesta and you're outdoors, like around 1 or 2 p.m., you're kind of out there rocking and you're looking at the plants and you're just relaxing and enjoying the heat because it's always hot, right? Yeah. But it's relaxing, you know?
Yeah, we have it outside, but also inside.
I like it inside almost better, I have to say. In Austria, you would have it inside. But we... actually, this is a glider chair. We always have to bring this up because Monica McGivern was schooling us on...
Thank you, Monica.
...that it is not a rocking chair, it's a glider chair. And my grandmother was actually sitting on a glider chair like that in her apartment all the time.
In Austria.
But it was a glider chair that was meant to be outside, but she had hers inside.
She was a
in
rebel
her kitchen.
Yeah. You.
She just had it like this.
Well, you have it inside as well, so I guess it's genetic that you're a rebel as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
So we talked a little bit about already all those amazing things you've been doing over the past couple of years, very internationally, or at least nationally, but you had a career for a long time. You've been in Miami for a long time. You've run Edge Zones for a very long time. I don't even know where to start. Where do you want to start, Charo?
Well, I can start from the beginning, I suppose.
Yeah.
I'm Dominican. I was born in Dominican Republic. And I was there until I was 10 years old, and my parents migrated, exiled. My father was a high-ranking officer in the Trujillo army. He was a dictator. And he had been dying to leave, but wasn't able to leave until the guy was killed. And so because of all the chaos that was going on in the country, we went to the States. I lived in Bayonne, New Jersey as a child. And then when I was 16, my parents, you know, things got better, so we went back to the Dominican Republic. And it was a shock both times, a shock leaving, you know, the idyllic sort of Dominican Republic and, you know, you
snow
could play,
for the first
yeah,
time.
Play I mean, outside. And then, you know, New Jersey was like, was kind of dirty looking. The buildings were all like gray, you know.
Very industrial,
yeah,
very
yeah.
lots of gray tones, darkish.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first, like Jersey City especially was not very nice. Bayonne was nicer. But, and then, you know, it was a shock going back as well because it was like going back to a country. I mean, this was 1969. 68, it was when, you know, the big explosion. Like, I wanted to go to Woodstock, although I had no idea what Woodstock really was. But my friends were going and I wanted to go. So going back to the Dominican Republic was a huge shock.
You're a teenager too, right?
Yeah,
you're going through
16.
All these changes and like... all the latest, everything is like almost close to you because like New Jersey, obviously next to New York,
yeah.
and you're like all this.
Yeah, I was just beginning to kind of discover all that, you know, and then that's the reason my parents accelerated, sent myself and my younger sister back before they moved back.
Oh
they
my
moved
God.
A year later. And because I wanted to be an American, you know, I didn't
yeah.
want to be sort of... So I was getting really used to it. And that's when they sent me back. And I went from like... when we were in America, we were living as immigrants. We just followed an uncle. My parents had to work in factories. Like, my parents had gone from my father, high-ranking officer, my mother, you know, the daughter of a high-ranking colonel, to, like, factory workers. You know, the story of exile. And then we went back to the Dominican Republic, and it was totally different. There I went to the most expensive school, and everybody was expected to go to Yale and Harvard, and my friends, was, you know, there was Dominican oligarchy. I mean, all of my friends had parents who had been presidents and things, and, you know, American American attachés and diplomats. And so I went from that to that in my sophomore year, which is pretty shocking because I had this heavy New Yorker accent, you know, and my friends all spoke, you know, really Ivy League English. So that was also another kind of adapting and having to, you know, and it was tough. It was tough for me because I then had to, you know, adapt to the Dominican Republic where you had to be a virgin and you had to be, you go out with that, what do you call it?
Like chaperone or
chaperones
something.
Chaperones and all that kind of thing, you know? So it was tough. And I even though I was in an American overseas school, the Dominicans did not live the same life as the Americans that went to that school. You know, mm-hmm. we were expected to be Dominicans. Mm-hmm. And so it's two very different lives. So that, until I lived in the Dominican Republic until I was 26 and I was able to finally get myself out again. I did all my own paperwork to get my residency again because my parents had turned it in. And so I went to New York when I was 26 to Manhattan, lived, you know, and I was trying to be an artist, but at the time I just wanted to survive and be able to pay my rent. And so I was working in offices as a secretary. And after a year or two, I just, you know, didn't really realize I wasn't doing what I wanted to do, you know, to be an artist. And so I had met someone in New York and went to Australia and lived there for like a year, and I was going to marry him.
Wow.
Didn't marry him. But it was he who actually got me back into the course of being an artist. He goes, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an artist. I said, why don't you do it? So when I went back to New York, I headed back to Santo Domingo where I could hang on my grandmother's house and just be an artist. And then I was in Altos de Chabon. And that's where my art career began, in 1981 or something like that, 80 to 81. And after a year, I decided I didn't, you know, I left Dominican Republic for reasons. I wanted to leave there again because I didn't really want to live there. So when moved from there, I had met a New Zealand woman through my Australian boyfriend who had also come to Dominican Republic with me. But she had lived in Europe, and I've always wanted to go to Europe. So I went to Europe with her because she kind of showed me the way to live. Lived in London for a year. That's kind of like, you know, my art career, I had a big exhibition and everything. With the money I took off to Europe, I lived there for a year in London, which was like the most amazing time to be in London. Because London was like the London of the beginning of the Thatcher era. It was like 81, the punk, you know, the goth.
Music scene was amazing.
The music scene.
Yeah.
It was a great time to be in London. I was living in Islington, had a squatter's den. You know, we were living there as squatters. And it was really it was the time.
Affordable still.
It was,
you could get cheap food and like.
Well, the food was not that cheap. Like, you couldn't eat meat because it was too expensive. Mm-hmm. But you could live in London. I mean, mm-hmm. London has never been cheap, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
but
kinda like
you
New
had
York.
A squatter. You could, you know, you could work here and whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's where I got married to William Cadell, and he was a filmmaker, and mm-hmm. There was a film boom in New Zealand, mm-hmm. So we decided to go live in New Zealand.
Wow.
So I moved with him to New Zealand.
How was that?
That was really amazing.
Did it look like Lord of the Rings?
It's like fantasy land for me. New Zealand is still, I've never been. I really want to go, but it sounds just such
it's
a fairy
paradise.
Tale. It's like,
yeah.
It's paradise, right?
Kind of. You know, it's at the time, this was 33 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was a very different New Zealand because New Zealand has a policy that they don't really allow, especially then, they were very, very racist in migration mm-hmm. policies. So there were really no blacks there. I mean, I think mm-hmm. I remember one black man, like mm-hmm. African American. What they call blacks are actually Maoris. The Maoris call themselves black in a sense, but they're not really black. I mean, they're, you know, they're Polynesians. And it's a very different thing. If you have black African blood, you know, it's very different way of being, you know, the way we laugh, the way we, you know, different energy totally. Mm-hmm. To me, the Maoris are more like South American, you know, indigenous people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see there's a connection there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I get asked if I'm Polynesian all the time.
Yeah. But not, I don't, you know, African, no. You know, even you get some Papua New Guineans who, like, they physically almost look like African people because they have, like, their hair is like, kinkyish, and but they're not as well. It's a totally different thing. The Melanesians, not the same thing. So for me, that was a tough part. I really missed the my African part, you know, my Afro-Caribbean part, being the only Dominican there. And but at the same time, the great thing about it was that I was able... The black part of me kind of rose, you know, and I missed it, and I and at the time the New Zealanders were decolonizing, so they were you know rethinking their history in reference to their you know the Maoris and the English and the colonial powers, and that's what started me on. Decolonizing. That's what started me thinking about the colonial heritage. You know, my relationship. My own family relationship with our blackness, the Dominican Republic relationship with their blackness, the whole denial of it, the whole way that we think we're Spanish, the way that, you know, people... And I had to start with my own family because my mother's black and my mother, in a way, is the most racist in my family. Was. She died not long ago, but she was the most racist in the way that a lot of black people are, and which is like a self-hatred. Like, you don't want your children to have to go through what you went through. Therefore, you want to marry someone white rather than have to, you know, your children to go through all the pain that you went. And that's, you know, it's kind of like a weird thing, you know? And it's kind of, it's hard to understand. At the same time, my mother was very proud of being black, you know, and she was just, but she would say, like, you know, it was, the whole thing is just kind of schizophrenic. So I had to start from my family and then my country, my family. And from there, I started reevaluating how we felt about it, how I thought about it, how we expressed ourselves, you know, why we made these choices about, you know, all these things. And to really understand, because I didn't go to Dominican schools, I went to Dominican schools until fourth grade, but I had been moving a lot. So my schooling was terrible before my fourth grade because my father was moved every 4 months, every 6 months, because the last years of Trujillo, he was kind of very
stationed in different places.
He didn't basically want people to become too friendly, all the militaries, and he was afraid of a coup, so he would move them. He would transfer them to other cities. And so we were moving every 6 months. I went to a boarding school age six. So my schooling was terrible until I got to America, fourth grade. And really started to, I blossomed actually when I came. And that's when I became an artist, actually age 10. I became the classroom artist. And someone for the first time actually acknowledged that I was really good in drawing, and you know that became my identity. And it was when I came to the U.S. age 10 that this happened. Prior to that, I had been drawing all the time in my notebooks. But my parents, who were very busy with their lives and all this, you know, things of
the, all
exile
the transitions
and all the,
and
you know, they weren't paying attention. Plus, it was a different era. You know, parents were. We're not expected to be these great, like, you know, taking care of kids, you know, like the way we are supposed to be doing it and, you know, looking at their home, like the school did that, you know. Then we had an extended family who also participated in the childhood, you know, care. And so it was when we got to America, my parents, we became closer. I mean, it's the first time I really had a lot to do with my father, especially. But nobody had never noticed that I was drawing, that was filling all my notebooks with drawings until this teacher said, oh my God, you're so good at drawing. I didn't even know that. I was just, you know, I just did that. And so, it, you know, coming to America was a big, big thing. And leaving America for the first time was also very difficult for me. There were traumas, you know. And I think most artists, we have traumas that
it
we
helps
work
heal
out
the artwork.
Through the art, you know.
That's where the art camp comes from, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, for me, all that. And then, you know, then I lived in New Zealand. In New Zealand, I did very, very well. In 4 years, I won three of the top prize that a New Zealand artist gets, which is the Queen Elizabeth II, you know, Arts Award.
Wow. And that's money was, too, that, right?
Yeah, it's like with the time it was like $5,000 New Zealand dollars, mm-hmm. which was
phenomenal.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
And I got it 3 times
wow.
in 4 years. But I was working really hard, and I, because I was a resident, not a citizen, I had to come back every year. So every year I would take this trip from New Zealand, which is really expensive, and sort of go around the world. Go to Europe, go to Santo Domingo, because, I was there in New Zealand and nobody came to visit you. So it was almost like you died.
Yeah.
You know, that was the only bad part about New Zealand. It was it's so wonderful and everything, but nobody would come visit you. So, and at the time we didn't have like phones like we have now, you know, it was expensive. You didn't have emails.
Letters
or like
to forever.
FaceTime, yeah. None of that. Like my daughter lived in Australia for 3 years, but I had a lot of connections with her through the phones. Not like me with my parents. So that's why, you know, reason why I wanted to leave, because I just couldn't really bear the idea of totally cutting away from my culture and my family, and also because my work had so much to do with. You know, colonizing with
yeah.
you know my own roots and my own culture. What was interesting, apparently, somebody told me this, was that, you know, one of the reasons I think I was successful in New Zealand was because I opened up a third space. You know, before me there was the Maoris and the whites, and there was nothing else. But in fact, there are other people in New Zealand. There were, especially the people from the Samoa and the different islands that are. You know, that are like the Papua New Guineans. You know, there's a lot of people from all the islands who actually live in New Zealand, but they were not represented in the art world there.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I wasn't from one of those islands, I was the other. And I was a third other. Like, I was a third, you know, lot. And I think that was something that they appreciated. So, in a way, they remember me for that reason. I'm you know, and I'm in their collections and stuff. I was recently in New Zealand two years ago, and it was really interesting to go back there. I have a lot of friends that I really care. For me, New Zealand's, I'm actually a citizen also.
That's amazing.
Wow.
I have a passport.
That's incredible.
Yeah, you know, it's a place that did a lot for me. And
so
my children have Kiwis too. My children.
You can go back anytime, and you can stay for as long as you want. Now you don't
there.
Have to leave,
yeah.
leave every year anymore.
Which is, come visit.
Yeah, like, and the funny thing is, like, New Zealand is like the place that, you know, all the wealthy people. It's like their escape route.
Yeah.
You know, because it is like this paradise that's so far away from everything that you figure
they're
if something
gonna
happens.
They're not going to go look for you.
Yeah. Well, if something happens, you know,
yeah.
nuclear, whatever, they think that's a safe place,
oh,
you know.
Oh, I understand.
So that's why they have this... these places is it is the escape plan, apparently.
You mentioned the growth of your work. Like when you were here in the States, you discovered through, you know, positive affirmation that you were an excellent craftsman in terms of writing and drawing and just completely filling up your sketchbooks, and your teacher admired that. What happened with the artwork when you went back home to the Dominican Republic, and then what happened with your artwork when you made it to New Zealand? How did it change?
Well,
visually.
You know, when I got to the Dominican Republic the first time, you know, I actually enrolled myself into an arts, fine arts place. You know, I actually went with my, said, you know, I heard about this place. I want to join this place. And it was the Bellas Artes, a fine arts school. And it was free. And they said, well, do you have a portfolio? I had no idea what a portfolio is. I said, well, I have this drawing pad that I draw. So I should, and they said, sure, then you can come. But it was in the afternoon. And sort of once I graduated high school, I had to, you know, I had to take these classes in the afternoon. So basically, I waited until I could pay my own classes. And that was my training until I came to Miami and got divorced when I was 42, that I actually went back to college and started from, like, zero in college and went to FIU and graduated summa cum laude there.
Awesome.
So I was mostly self-trained. So when I was in Santo Domingo, I was... I had my first exhibition. The work was abstract, and interesting enough, it was wood. I work with wood a lot, and found wood, or wood that's not very painted and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's been my form of doing from the very beginning. And I had totally forgotten that. Alette reminded me that I was doing that in my first exhibition. I've always been one of these people who wants to do not just painting, but sculpture and drawing and works on paper. And that's, my practice has always been 6 months this, 6 months that. Mm. So in Dominican Republic, I had that show and then I left. And then when I was in New Zealand, it's really where my work really kind of started. And it was a lot of painting, drawing, wood sculptures, etchings. I start etching in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So my shows would be, have all of the above. Would have etchings, with paintings, large paintings. I was painting in oils then.
Oh, nice.
And the themes were very much Afrocentric. They were personal. But they also, I wanted to paint women that were strong. Mm-hmm. And at first I started painting women. My reference would be kind of the Catholic Church. Because as I said, I was in Catholic Church age 6. Going to, boarding school, having to go to mass every day. Mm-hmm. So I had, the iconography of the church, mm-hmm, was something that I kind of grew up with. And it was very strong. And, the images of the Madonnas and all of that and the woman. But when I was in Santo Domingo, I wanted to make these really heavy screaming mommy watas, these kind of screaming women. Mm-hmm. Because I felt really... at the time, that women were treated very badly there. That's one of the reasons I left the country. Because I didn't consider myself a feminist, but I definitely didn't like the way women were treated and the way that, we were second-class citizen. And, the fact that, you came... When I went back the third time, I went back for like a year and a half when I was separated from my husband. My daughter was like, this has been 88. I had a big curriculum, and because I was a woman, I was I was really disrespected often. Like, they would leave me waiting, and they invite me to like a program, and then I'd be sitting there for hours, like, what happened? And, oh, we canceled, and you couldn't tell me this? Just things like that, that you knew that it was, if you had been a man, they wouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of that, even in my own family, and that really pissed me off, and I said, I can't live in this country. And I left there for that reason. So every time I would leave for the same sort of ideological reasons, mm-hmm. So when I came, in New Zealand, my work was very much, was large paintings and very expressive. And when I came to Miami, I had a little girl, I had a studio at the South Florida Art Center, and I started to do first paintings and ceramics as well. And photo performances and installation. That's when I started the installations.
So that new turn happened here in Miami?
That happened in Miami.
What building were you in?
Installation. Although my photo performance has started in New Zealand, but okay. I wasn't taking my own photos. Somebody else had taken, and I got very angry because she insisted the nags were hers.
Oh.
Even though we had agreed that, she was going to take the photos, but they were mine because mm-hmm. it was my art, it was yeah. my ideas. She wouldn't give me the nags. So after that, I used my own camera and put it, so that was a big lesson. So I started to do photo performances where I would and do the installations and put myself in it. But I was still very shy about performing live. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I was starting to do... The installations didn't start until 1999. Mm-hmm. But I went back to school
when I
was 42. Mm-hmm. Yeah, around 95, when I got separated and divorced. So I decided to go back to school, mainly because... I was a little bored, and I felt like I need more conversation. That's one of the things I miss with my ex-husband. And mm-hmm. I felt like, I'll go to school and then there'll be some, my brain, I didn't want to be at home with just two kids. So it was interesting because I did a lot of, with the money that I borrowed, I did a lot of research into Afro-Dominican culture and mm-hmm. and rituals. And so I would go back to Santo Domingo, and I that's when I started Edge Zones. Mm-hmm. It was called Miami Performance Miami Arts Collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so I started to do things with the Dominican culture here in Miami. Like, who are the Dominicans here?
I know.
What are they
like
doing?
You mentioned Aleta. I was like, duh, Aleta's Dominican. That makes perfect sense.
I started to go to Arapara and, you know, see who they were. And we started to do programs where we would bring Dominican artists to Miami. And
it is exchange, kind of like doing exhibitions there, performances there, here.
I was doing the international exchange, but I was doing it through Rhythm, the Rhythm Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they were basically my Laura Quinlan was my mom in that way. She introduced me to the nonprofit world. Like, mm-hmm. actually, she and Ruben, this other Dominican artist who actually lived in New York and knew a lot about these things. So we started that, and then we were working, doing the international exchange project, bringing people from Miami to Santo Domingo and Santo Domingo to Miami. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was very useful because the people that I was bringing were people who, like myself, were also researching Afro-Dominican culture. Mm-hmm. They were going to the bateis. They were going into the fields. Because there was not a lot of things that are really written down about Afro-Dominican, like voodoo. Because voodoo was actually illegal in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. You know, Trujillo, we had a dictator who anything that was black, anything that was Haitian, was... he killed many Haitians, many, many Haitians. Mm-hmm. So nobody wanted to be Haitian. Nobody wanted to be voodoo, because if you're voodoo, you were Haitian. So all of that went underground for 30 years. So it wasn't until the 70s, the late 70s, that some people started to, like someone like Luis Diaz, who started to actually surface all of this music and research it and bring it out. Mm-hmm. Because it was illegal, mm-hmm. and it was underground. Mm-hmm. So my friends, there were people who were actually, Eddie Sanchez.
They were on site looking at these things and finding them.
But they were musicians who were recuperating Dominican, Afro-Dominican music. I didn't know any other Dominican visual artists that were doing the same thing that I my part was coming from the visual end. So I started going with them into the fields. And so I would go there and, you know, I would pay for the gas. They would take me and we would learn, and I would document, and I would that's where all my learning for to understand Afro-Dominican culture really clearly came from. That I went to Bates, that's where I learned about Rara, and also about the Haitian-Dominican relations, you know, because
it is one island.
There's something that, you know, I wanted to know, why was there all this, you know, friction? Where is it coming from? Because I saw that, you know, to me, when I was looking for Afro-Dominican imagery, I had to go to the Haitian or the Cubans, because they had it. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find a lot of things in, you could go to look in things for Africa, but in Dominican Republic, there was very little of that was actually documented. You couldn't find it in many forms. Once when I was in 88, I was in Santo Domingo, in the museum, they had Robert Farris Thompson had brought a group, and they had done a thing on Dominican Gaga, which is Dominican version of Rara. And this is when I first learned about Rara. And I basically wanted so badly to go into the fields, but I had no way of going there, because it's not something you can just do on your own without anyone. You know, we're talking about going into the fields of sugarcane areas that are, you know, outside.
Yeah, into a mountain, to the countryside. And in order to be able to even enter those kind of spaces, you have to have some local that will be, hey, this person's okay, they're just trying to learn. I mean, people are wary. I mean, it was hidden for so long, so it makes
sense.
Totally.
And it's dangerous. It's places the police doesn't go to, especially today, because a lot of, you know, the sugarcane industry has been dismantled. So many of the places that used to have sugarcane have nothing, no work. So you can imagine, what are these people? And then you have the situation in the Dominican Republic where the Haitians, a lot of them, their birthrights are being, you know, contested. Like, they're not supposed to leave. First of all, a lot of these people came to the Dominican Republic to cut sugarcane, and they really probably weren't even asked, do you have a birth certificate or anything? They just came, and they lived, and they had, you know, kids. And then their kids were born in Dominican Republic. They consider themselves, they've never been to Haiti, they consider themselves Haitians. And now there's this law that's saying that, you know, if your mother's not Haitian, if your mother's not Dominican, you're not Dominican. And so, you know, they're afraid to leave these areas. You know, they're impoverished and have no jobs, but even if they leave these areas, they could be caught in the cities and then sent back to Haiti. So they're in a real dire situation, many of them. There's a lot of poverty in there. I mean, when people wish for the sugarcane industry to come back, that's pretty heavy, because it's really one of the worst jobs you can get.
It's,
you
know, so physical.
It's physical, you're in the sun, you could be cut, you know, you don't get paid for anything. It's terrible. The living conditions aren't good, you know. So I go to these areas by myself with cameras and equipment. So, you know, and at first I used to go with people, but often, you know, people can't go and, you know, I want to document it. So I had to become brave and go on my own. And it was going there that I've met people that are now my kind of connections there, mm-hmm. who will keep me safe in a sense, will say here, you know, come through here, or introduce me to people, or, you know, make me walk this way or that, or don't take photographs to these people. So you have to, you know, my friends ask me, who do I have to call if something happens to you every time I go? Because it is pretty dangerous. To me, my danger is not so much even being there, but actually getting there, on the way there, because I'm going through really rough areas and these little vans that are, you know, anything can happen to you in those vans, you know. So, and I'm here with, you know, American-looking Americans. They think of me as American, even though I'm not, you know. They can tell you're a foreigner.
And then the equipment, or,
expensive equipment.
They know that you have money, or...
Well, they think you do, but, you know, the fact that you're there, right away, you stick out like a sore thumb, because a Dominican of my class...
Wouldn't go there.
Would never, ever, in the million year be found there. You know, so they know that you're not a regular Dominican, that you have to be foreign in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing, but for me, the going, you know, the rah-rah, the documenting and researching that has opened up to things like the Arayanos or Dominican Haitians, getting to know the communities, people I would never normally know. Mm-hmm. You know, even though you have, like, now there's a lot of Haitians in the capital that, you know, but Dominicans, if you ask them, they know very little about Haitians. And I would say the same thing with the Haitians living in Haiti. They know very little about Dominicans. Mm-hmm. We live with our backs to each other. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of friction. So there's, you know, a lot of things that people say about each other. And people don't know even, like, what Haitians eat, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned a lot about Haitians also living in Miami. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, I remember, like, I would have Haitian music up really loud, and you'd see this Haitian person go like, what is this? You know, I'm like, oh, you know, this is a gallery or something. Because I would have a project, one of these exchange projects, and I just have the Haitian music out loud, and they just couldn't believe it, mm-hmm. you know? Because people, and if you, like, I have friends of mine who have Haitian mates, and said, do you know what they eat? They have this great food. They had no idea, you know? Like, I did a project called Two Flags, which basically involved having a Dominican and a Haitian cooking what they consider to be, like, the main dish. And this was in a museum, and everybody was amazed at the fact that a lot of the food they considered to be Dominican, their grandmas or somebody cooked, was actually a Haitian meal. It was a Haitian food, you know, and they didn't know that. And so it was really amazing to them, you know, what the Haitians ate, that actually is not very different from the Dominicans, you know. So it's been through that journey of research and understanding that it's been an amazing journey, in a sense, and a research. And it's what's giving my work the base of what it is today. You know, mm-hmm. I have used all that, those concepts and the understanding and all that imagery. I've used it. Like, I learned about, not just about performance, but also about installation. Really, the first time I went to it was a place called Mata Los Indios, mm-hmm. Where I went with a friend, because she says, you have to come and see this. And we went, and I said, okay. It was the Saint Michael, mm-hmm. They have Saint Michael, but it's also Ogun Baghdadi. And they have these two people who come, mm-hmm. they come from these different villages. They come and they exchange these. They come with these things in their heads. And same thing that the Catholics do. Mm-hmm. But this is not a Catholic. It's actually a voodoo ceremony because, mm-hmm. you know, it's very syncretic.
It sounds like something, yeah, like how they had to hide the names of certain gods with the more colonial gods in order to be able to continue practicing. Yeah,
mm-hmm. exactly. So, you know, that's what the whole syncretic thing is, you know, in order to you dress something up and you do it, you can do it when it's you can do it, which is like saying, oh, it's St. Michael's, mm-hmm. you know. So basically I brought some materials and I started working with them to help them do the, you know, the little girls were just like angels and stuff. And in there I saw these people transform a room that was like a little shack into like an altar, into this amazing magical room. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's when I understood what installation was. And I said, now I understand, because to me installation was like, I didn't make sense. I couldn't see myself doing installation because mm-hmm. it was all these like high tech, very expensive stuff. No, you can transform, you can make a space with nothing. These people worked with somebody's bedcloth, somebody's tablecloth, somebody's bedspread with crepe paper,
whatever you have,
mm-hmm. you know, what do you call it, rope, anything, string, mm-hmm. glitter. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, then I can do this too. And this is where I started to do installation. Mm-hmm. Installation, performance, all of that starts from that sort of documenting and learning and seeing these people doing this incredible stuff. You know, mm-hmm. like my Rara, of course, now is very much a processional, is very much based on the Rara and the Gaga. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's also to understand that it's not just to understand it artistically, but also politically. Mm-hmm. Because the Rara is very much a thing of resistance. It is a way of showing, giving a face to people who are normally marginalized, who are normally not seen. They go out in the middle of the day. In Easter, when Easter in my country is a Catholic country, you're not allowed to make any noise, any music. They actually come and close they'll shut down your shop or your restaurant if you have any music going on. And these people, even though they are doing it in sort of the more like marginalized areas, they're playing very loud music and they're dancing and they have very strong colors, you know, and they're saying, we're here. And, you know, they're becoming visible and they're mapping. They're saying, this is our territory. So when you look at it as a political strategy, it's a really interesting political strategy to sort of to show, you know, to become visible, mm-hmm. and to place, make a mark in a place. You know, mm-hmm. the Haitians do it here in Little Haiti. If you go on a Friday or a Saturday, you will see, especially if you know what a Rara is, you will see them marching. And I discovered that for the first time years ago and I'm like, this is a Rara.
Down the street, yeah.
Jumped on it and followed them. And it was the first time that I really felt at home in Miami. Like, I felt like, this is like, I can't believe this. I got so much joy out of that. Because I could, you know, this is the real home thing, you know, and that's here in Miami. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, all of that research and all that understanding, all of that was giving my work a base and strength and kind of reality, you know, and it's what gives it a continuity. It's like I never finish. Like, it's never like, oh, I have nothing to say. You know, there's always like, you know, because I think as an artist, you always think like, you know, what can I find? That was my big question when I first started being an artist. Like, what is it that it's going to continue, that I'm going to be able to continue to do for the rest of my life?
You know, that you don't run out of material, basically, right? That there is a well that is always going to be full in a way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's what I wanted to identify. When I first started in New Zealand, and I said, what is it that I'm going to be able to continue doing? You know, what is that heavy, you know, the artery in my body that's going to give me that juice all the time, you know? And it was that. It was, you know, working with identity, because to me that was probably one of the most, I think, painful or a question, the one thing that I really had a lot of question about, and I felt was unresolved, you know, both with my family, with my country, you know, with, and then the world, you know, and then you come to Miami and And here you are, you know, like the same thing. I was working for a nonprofit where, you know, they segregated basically. You had the whites, you had the blacks, and you had the Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And like, but I'm like, no, we're all the same people here. And I would be the one that would actually, I remember showing up in the white women's changing room and like, and how like they were like really upset, you know, that I was there. And I'm like, because I'm one of these people that will go through barriers. I don't, you know, I don't believe in these things that other people create. I say, you know, I'm a disruptor, mm-hmm. you know? So for me, that was really interesting. That's when I first arrived in Miami and realized how the city was very marginalized and very much in a way in an apartheid. This is the South, you know? Yeah. And Miami's come a long way from when I first arrived in 89 to what it is today. But I think if you go into any of the really high power situations, you're gonna find, you know, the whites in the top and the Hispanic and then the blacks, you know? Mm. And I felt, you know, my black sisters, we're not, you know, we're not, we, you know, when we realize, okay, this is what they're trying to do, wait, no, no, you know, we're the same here, you know? And it was really interesting what happened from that, you know? So, this city is an interesting city. I love this city. The city's been really great for me. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of things like, you know, the nonprofit and, you know, it's
the
a city.
The Performance Festival.
The Performance Festival.
And the Edge Zones as a gallery space as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I had a 25,000 square foot building when I first started yeah. Edge Zones.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
We're like huge. Some of the pioneers in Wynwood, you mm-hmm. know, from 2003 to 2008, I was in that building where I had an art fair called Zones Art Fair, which was the first, really, the first local art fair to actually be in the same place as, you know, like parallel to Art Basel, because mm-hmm. Miami, Art Miami actually disappeared the first 1 or 2 years. So I actually had an art fair, a local art fair that was parallel to Art Basel, you know.
When no one else did
when
it.
When no one else did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had that. And it was, you know.
It's incredible.
It was a place that local artists and people from the Caribbean had a space, mm-hmm. had a place. And we did that until like 2000. Then, like, you know, we were in that building in 2008. In 2008, the building sold and I got another space on 25th. Northeast 25th, also in Wynwood, which I had for 3 years. It was a much smaller venue. We continued the art fair for a couple of more years because mm-hmm. We had another art fair. Was it, what's the name of the one that's in Aqua?
Aqua
yes. Had a huge building there right across from us.
Oh, mm-hmm. Instead of doing it on the beach?
So we had, so we had basically an art fair that would bring us, you know, bus loads of people right
because
in front.
Because Aqua was right there. And then
right across from us. So we did that until Aqua closed. And then, you know, it got more difficult. But we were doing the art fair. And we also did a lot of publications. We were the first to really publish Miami artists, you know, in books here. Like we did WET, which I think was 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008. We published 4 books, one very small, then one basically of the programming that we had the whole year. Mm-hmm. We had these books that we would, for us, the main strategy was to make sure that Miami artists would be documented.
Represented and documented.
Represented, and we would have them for sale in places like the Rubel Collection, the different museums, the Bass, the Mocha.
So great. Mm-hmm.
And in the same space, you know, that's occupied by Picasso books or whatever kind of books, in the same space was Miami artists. So that mm-hmm. was a strategy of ours mm-hmm. to put us in the same, you know, level. Mm-hmm. We did it until like 2008, which, you know, was, we were going to do another one. And because things got so bad economically, mm-hmm. we weren't able to, although it is online.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The one that's on our international exchange programs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've done a lot of things. A lot of people can tend to forget. It's interesting that they talk
Miami
about
has
Miami.
A very short memory too. Yeah.
It's always short. About what's next, but I think that happens a lot in the oral. Like, what are you working on now? What's your latest work? What's new? So it's always about forgetting the past, but just like focusing on the future.
Yeah.
Versus enjoying the present, I feel sometimes.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, I'm not going to mention names, but I was in a meeting the other day and they were talking about the history of Miami and all these different spaces and all these different artists that were, you know, artist-led things. And they didn't mention us. I, thank God I was there and I yelled out, Edge Zones, you know, because I'm like, true, this person that was talking had not been here during that time, mm-hmm. the time that maybe we were doing all this, you mm-hmm. know? But I think it also has to do with color, you know? I think that if you're an artist of color, or if you know, I'm not saying that we were all only artists of color, because I'm very inclusive. I include everyone. I don't believe in ghettos. But I think because it's led by me, you know, or like even they don't even mention Diaspora Vibe, who also should have been mentioned as well, because they were doing things, a lot of things, mm-hmm. they're still doing things, you know. I mean, especially our international exchange programs are mm-hmm. probably, people here don't realize how important they are to Miami. Mm-hmm. But because we go out there and we do the footwork that we, and I do a lot of it only, a lot only with Dominican Republic, but we've done a lot of things. We've taken Miami artists to China, to Seaside Fair, to Basel quite a few times. We've had, you know, shows parallel to Art Basel with Miami artists. We've taken them, we've done it in El Salvador, Puerto Rico, Arco, mm-hmm. Arco, the big art fair in Madrid. Mm-hmm. We've had stalls there with Miami artists. So we have been in Madrid and all over Spain. I've done a lot of things with Miami artists. Mm-hmm. So these things are not necessarily known here in Miami.
Yeah.
But we definitely have been, you know, doing a lot for, because I'm foreign myself, you know, and I have a different kind of view of what Miami is for the Caribbean and Latin America. To me, to us, it's very much a gateway and the place that we all come to and we all mix, you know. So for us, for me, that idea of also not just them coming here, but us going there was also really important. So
because it's about this network also that you are building.
I mean, Marie is here because of you, basically. You invited her to a performance.
That's right.
She met her now husband, and now she's here. So there
right.
you go.
I would not be here without you.
Right. Well, you know, and that's the sort of thing. You know, it's mm-hmm. like we do things. Our network is very big. Mm-hmm. internationally, mm-hmm. nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. And people here may not know about this, but it's very important to Miami. You know, when we take artists to, let's say, Dominican Republic, it's a small country, but they get to network with the top of that country, which often has connected them to New York, to Europe, to all kinds of, you know, network that they wouldn't have, that Miami artists wouldn't have.
If they just stayed
if it
here.
Wasn't through yeah. that
through
situation.
Those exchanges, yeah.
Through programs. Those exchanges. And that's happened over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I could, you know, sit here until tomorrow giving you examples of, you know, covers that, you know, inclusion in books and magazines, in museum shows and shows internationally that have come through Miami. A lot mm-hmm. of times we don't even know about it. They don't tell us. Mm-hmm. But we know.
Eventually.
Because when you connect, you say, wait a minute, this person didn't know. So we
how
know that
they,
how that
where
connection
did they
happened,
find?
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's we've done a lot of things as, you know, and myself as the lead, you know, person in Edge Zones mm-hmm. Here, which I think are very important and I hope people don't forget them.
Well, I think that's another reason why we're working on this archive is to be able to save these voices and just you guys exist. You guys exist here locally, and I think it's very important for outsiders that are not necessarily living in Miami or South Florida, for Lauderdale, etc., to be aware that they do exist. Mm-hmm. One last question for me. I'll make it short, and then Maria's going to ask her final question. Switching from curator to working for a not-for-profit to being an artist, how do you feel that you find the balance between those three things?
Juggling act. I'm a good juggler, and I have a lot of energy. So I've always, you know, I've been a mom too, so I raised two kids. So I've known how to put things on a stop mm-hmm. and, you know, in hiatus and then pick jump up. Onto the next thing. It's very bad for painting. Like if you're painting figurative, it's terrible. But I somehow other managed to help, and they kind of, they help each other.
Yeah.
You know, they feed off each other. I've learned a lot through being on both sides. It's also done me some harm as far as being, you know, an artist and who sells artwork or used to sell artwork. And that's been, you know, because dealers see you as competition and they say like, oh, do I want to introduce this person to an important collector, you know, where they maybe they don't sell their art, but they sell somebody else's work. So that's been detrimental. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't want to be working so much with, you know, selling art or exhibition, but more with festivals that are short term and not, you know. So I think that's something that most artists have to be aware of when they get
what
into
what path they choose. Yeah.
Yeah, and the path that it sometimes can be good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Our very last question. You've been sitting in a magical rocking chair and it grants you three wishes. You can wish for anything and everything, but you have to say it out loud for it to come true. These are the rules of the rocking chair. So what are your three wishes?
Oh my God, three wishes. I don't know. God, I can't think of anything right now. I think that I hope that Miami continues to grow in a very positive way where it includes everyone, mm-hmm. and that people, you know, especially that artists of colors can find a place to mm-hmm. be represented and not, you know, thought of as less. Mm-hmm. So I hope, you know, great things for Miami. And I'm going to go even further. I'm going to hope for this world right now that is in a very difficult place.
Yeah.
We'll have a good resolution mm-hmm. to what we're facing now. I hope that, you know, the world will wake up to what's going on and that we are not going to continue in the path that we're going right now, because I think it's a very dangerous path. Mm-hmm. And politically, we are, it's very scary to mm-hmm. me. I've lived under dictatorships. I know what that is. I think this country is an amazing country. I love this country. And I think has stood for many great things to many people in the world. I think we're losing some of that great standard. And I think that once you lose that, it's very difficult to win it back again.
Yeah.
So I think that I hope we don't continue to go in that path where we lose the prestige that we've had and the goodwill of many people and the trust of many people, because that's going to be very difficult to gain. I think this country, you know, I mean, I'm going to be hope. Radical hope is a thing for my work. And I'm going to hope for the best mm-hmm. and hoping that, you know, that we will resolve this in a good way. Mm-hmm. And that was my second wish. My third wish, I hope, you know, good health for myself, my family, and for mm-hmm. those people I love. Mm-hmm. That's what I can think.
Thank you very much for coming to sit with us, Charo.
Thank you so much, Charo.
We'll be linking up your website to ours so that people can see you and find out more about what you're doing and your upcoming exhibits, which you have one, actually, that you're preparing for
in Washington,
pretty soon.
D.C.
Washington, and Dimensions Variable. I have one in January.
Oh,
a solo show. I'm really looking forward to that.
Check it out, 2020. Yes. Charo Okens will be in Dimensions Variable.
Well deserved.
That's exciting. Thank you, Maria. And thank you to our listeners. And
thank you both for inviting me. It's been wonderful. Really appreciate it.
Next week. Yes, it was a pleasure. 126.
We're going to be back next week, Monday.
127.
That's it. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, thank you.